What is up, Surf Splendor podcast listeners? This is your host, David Scales. Welcome back for yet another hour of surf news. Although today I have a new co-host, Scott Bass is actually out of town. So Tom Resvin, Southern California kind of ex-current slash pro surfer, but really interesting dude, a lot of time in the surf biz and surfing around the world, actually. So great guy, good friend of mine. Glad to introduce you to him. And then if you're new to Surf Splendor, welcome to the show. I encourage you track down the episode that I did last week, which was with the founder of Surfing Magazine. His name is Richard Graham and was involved in launching the Lightning Bolt label. He was involved in Hang Ten Clothing. So he's got a super interesting background in surf history, really influential player, you know, was a part of all sorts of different movements and evolution, and was friends with pretty much everybody and anybody who came up in surfing from the 70s and 80s. So please listen to that. He's actually running a Kickstarter campaign right now to fund the final stage of production in a coffee table book that he's putting together called The Ride. And I think there's about a week left. Actually, I think there's 10 days left in that Kickstarter campaign. So if you'd like to participate in that, contribute to it, get that done in the next 10 days. Looks like he's going to hit his goal, or he's close to it anyways, but I'm sure he could use your help. And additionally, I think there's over 40 episodes of Surf Splendor in the archives now. Sean Thompson, Chris Cote, lots of interesting guests. So I encourage you, just go back. You can find everything for free archived on surfsplendorpodcast.com and also in iTunes and Stitcher and wherever you download podcasts. If you listen in iTunes or Stitcher, just please make sure to rate and review the show. That helps other people to find it, and it helps the audience grow. And we really appreciate you doing that. The show has been growing every week, every episode, and each month the download numbers get stronger and stronger. And I'm working on some new concepts and ideas for 2015, which will involve travel. And so if we can continue to increase this show's listenership, we should be able to find underwriters or sponsors that can help me get to those destinations that I need to get to produce shows in 2015. So I'm excited for what's to come, but it's still a long way off. So right now, just keep growing the base, growing the listenership, and we really appreciate your assistance in helping us do so. So without further ado, this is David Scales saying thank you for listening. Enjoy today's show, and I will be back in the end to sign us off. Welcome to the show, Resi.
Thank you very much.
Tom Resvin is our co-host for today. I gotta say, like, I've actually wanted to implement you into this show for a long time now. I know we talked a year or two ago about doing some sort of documentary that would have been video, but as I've kind of been exploring this audio platform, I'm like, dude, I don't know how to tell Resi's story, but someone's got to document the story. And I think this is a good platform to do it, but I don't know the right where to begin. The story's not over. We're in the middle somewhere, so I don't know,
man. The story's over when I die.
Exactly. But it's a long ways away still, so it's kind of like, but it's a super interesting story. But another thing, kind of before we get into your story, that I don't think I ever told you was my first exposure to you was in high school. I collected every surf magazine that would come out, which was two, basically, Surfer and Surfing. And you're on the back cover, that Rip Curl back cover advertisement, doing that layback.
Yeah, I remember.
That was my first introduction, and I was able to retain a lot of information back then, so I knew every surfer's name, who their sponsors were. I'm like, dude, Tom Resvin, who's this guy? This guy's ripping. So that was my first exposure to you.
Thanks. No, that was a good moment.
So what's the story, dude? What's your pro surfing background? Or
I like to just consider myself a surfer, I guess I surf on a professional level, or I I've been a pro surfer. I don't know what you want to call it, because there's so many levels of pro surfing these days. You know, you have the pro surfers that surf on the world tour. You have professional free surfers.
Right.
Then you have these guys that are hired by companies for lifestyle and modeling, and the fact that they're good at music and art, but they get paid to surf. I don't know. So, and then you have guys that are surfing on a high level that don't always get a paycheck, but are on a professional level, not on an amateur level. Right. So,
well, what was your like time frame that you came up in? Mid-90s, I'd say?
Yeah, exactly. From going from amateur to professional, mid-90s, yeah.
Okay.
I'm from that mid-90s, early 2000s generation, but I'm still driven to push my surfing till this day. I always believe in improving yourself, not just in the water, but in every aspect of life.
Which is an important part of your story, and we'll get into that. But in the mid-90s... Mm-hmm. So you were competing in the mid-90s. Who were you competing against at that time? And do you have any specific stories of guys who we know? Mm. Like matchups with anybody?
I mean, gosh, it's hard to come up with the memories right off the bat. But a contest that stands out is I remember at Trussell's, is one of my favorite waves is lowers. I had to do, like, from the very beginning trials. And I think it started all the way in Oceanside. I had to go through, two or three heats and... I had to go surf against like a guy who I think it was in, he was in like the Momentum like videos. He had a couple waves, like Hayden Alessandro.
Oh yeah.
Then Rap Boy, and then I eventually got into to surf lowers, and the waves were 6 to 8 foot faces every day till the end. And then I got to surf against like Bruce Irons, and Chris Drummy was on top then. This guy Brandy Faber was on top then. I surfed, I think, 7 rounds, and so I got to surf 5 of those rounds at lowers, 6 to 8 foot, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And I remember I got to beat Bruce Irons in one heat, which was cool because, I mean, that was, he was 18, I think I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't say that he was total ground, but at 18, Kelly, I think, won lowers in black and white. So
Felipe Toledo's 18.
Yeah, exactly. So but that, you know, Bruce Irons is an amazing surfer, so I was pretty stoked.
That's right.
And then it just
where'd you finish in that comp?
Oh, I think I made the heat right before the quarterfinals.
Okay.
You do all that work.
I know.
And the TV rounds were the quarterfinals, and I made it right before, so you know, forgotten to most, but not to me. But
that's awesome.
And then I've also made semis and stuff in the in the lower rated events, like that. What is it? The 2 stars and 3 stars at Newport Beach.
Yeah.
There's Timmy Reyes, Micah Byrne. Those guys were still doing that contest at lowers. I remember they were in the trials rounds, but there were Groms. I can only imagine they must have been 16 or so. I remember seeing the names in the heat sheets. So.
Right.
They were around back then.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, we will figure out a way to devote a show or maybe multiple shows to kind of a lot of your history, because there's a lot that we're not going to get into today.
Yeah. No,
but a couple things that I do want to point out is like, you've surfed that wave pool in Dubai.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
still travel a lot on your own dime. You just got back, right? There was a giant swell in Indo and Tahiti and stuff.
Yes, I went to Desert Point for my birthday. I saw a swell coming. I was initially trying to go about a month and a half ago. My dad got an infection, so I had to stay and advocate for him. And then, so another swell was coming right on my birthday, and I saw it 6 days in advance. And I have this pass, airline pass, that I go on standby. So I just went, boom, strike mission, got Desert Point for 4 days, 2 epic days, and the other couple days we're watching the swell increase. But it was firing. That was June 19th and 20th.
Okay, we saw all that swell, like on Surfline was tracking it and posting that.
Correct.
That Tavarua session, Cloudbreak session with like Bobby Martinez and Kelly Slater.
It was around the same time. Yes. South Pacific is active. So
right.
It came all
so over. You said you surfed Desert Point a couple days and then watched the swell rise the next couple days?
Yeah, I was surfing when it was 1 foot, warming up as it went to chest high. And then I think on the 19th, it was head high in the morning. And then I went and had lunch. Next thing I know, I took a nap for an hour, wake up, and it's 8 to 10 foot faces. And I'm like, wow, this place changes like in a snap of a finger. I knew that. Desert Point's a weird wave. Like, within a matter of 2 hours, it'll go from chest high to double overhead.
Yeah.
So it's,
so, but you paddle out there, right? When it's that big, or
yeah, that's yeah. not that's to me that's not big. I mean, okay. it's a, this day and age, big is 30 foot.
No,
so
I know. Well,
put to 80 foot. So
when you word the way you worded it is, I watched the swell rise. I was thinking watching it from the beach.
Holy crap!
It's getting big.
No. Like you know, monitoring it and then surfing through it being flat.
Sure. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. How was your experience in that wave pool in Dubai?
Amazing.
You've been there a couple times, right?
Yes, twice. Okay. I saw Globe's video.
Electric Blue Heaven.
Yeah, Electric Blue Heaven. And I was just so mesmerized by it because I remember seeing the first viral video 6 months earlier of the guys that actually work at the wave pool surfing it. But when I saw Electric Blue Heaven, I got to see the kind of airs that Dion was doing, which was amazing. And the cinematography was amazing. And I wanted to see if it was attainable to anybody. And so I just instantly went to the internet. Thank goodness, you know, we have that resource. And I looked for the website of the wave pool. I looked for the contact number. I Skyped over there. I got a hold of a guy, Riley Heffernan, who's an Australian. Or I think he's from New Zealand. I'm not really sure. But he's like, yeah, you can book time. So then I went to a couple of my sponsors. And I go, hey, I'm going to go to this wave pool that everyone's been talking about from Dion's video. Within 2 weeks after the video was aired. And I go, it would be cool to do it while it's fresh. Mm-hmm. And also, no one from the United States has gone. And so I went and I did it. And it was amazing. And it really helped improve my aerial technique, which is something I definitely think I needed improvement on. And it was amazing how much you can learn and how quickly you can learn in such a short time span.
Because it's like a machine, a machine-like wave. You just practice the same thing.
Yeah, over yeah. It's repetition, muscle memory, confidence. You get in the zone. I mean, there's 36 waves in 1 hour, which is ridiculous. Usually you catch 36 waves in 4 hours.
And you're out there by yourself?
You're out there by yourself, and it's the cost is ridiculous. At that time, I think the cost was $160 for an hour. Now, I think at Walt Disney World, that would cost you in the thousands.
Yeah, for sure.
And that wave isn't as good. So it was, and I flew standby again to that location on this airline pass I have. So the trip was a fraction of the cost. And I think the whole trip paid for itself with all the coverage I got and all the payment I got from my sponsors at the time from photo incentives and whatnot.
That's insane. So I don't know if... I'm just like for listeners who don't fully understand the inner workings of professional surfing, they understand it on Kelly Slater's level or those guys' levels. But for a guy like you, it seems like there's a tremendous amount of expense chasing swell. Mm-hmm. And how do you get the time off work? And what are some of the logistics involved in making this stuff happen? How do you do it?
Well, you need to find a job that's flexible,
okay,
that lets you take time off if you want to be a traveling surfer. And that's difficult to do in the United States. A lot of people are tied to their jobs. So
for sure.
I work for a school district part-time. It's 6 hours and 15 minutes.
A day?
A day.
Okay.
And it starts in the afternoons, like 3 o'clock. So I also get entitled to a lot of vacation days. I've been there for 21 years, coming 22.
Wow.
I've actually been one of the most employed people that I know.
Yeah.
I've never been unemployed in my life. A lot of people think I don't work. A lot of people think that I may have a trust fund, or they think that I came into some money or whatnot. But I work, believe it or not. You just won't see me on evening sessions Monday through Friday.
Right.
So I get 20 paid vacation days, which is more than what the average person gets. The average person may get 10 or 11. At my job, after being there X amount of years, you get these seniority days. So I get 20 paid vacation days, paid holidays, paid sick days. And I do strike missions, meaning I don't go to Indo for a month like the average person.
Right.
I don't go for 2 week trips. Mine are short trips, 4 days at the location, sometimes only three. And I have to time it and make sure that those are the days the swell's there. And for the wave pool, you only really need 2 days.
Sure.
8 hours of surfing, you've caught hundreds of waves.
It's a lot of travel though for 2 days of surfing.
Correct, but I can handle it. You have to be in shape and all that and ready to handle jet lag. And I'm a very hyper guy, active guy. So to me, I like it. I like the rush of traveling.
there's another detail, which you've referred to, which is the standby pass.
Correct.
Because if you're going to fly last minute to Dubai for Joe Schmo,
yeah,
probably not going to be cheap.
Okay, yeah. As a matter of fact, doing strike missions is more expensive than planning your trip a month or two in advance.
Sure.
Which is what most people do, and then they get skunked or they only get one swell.
Mm-hmm.
I've been fortunate. Everything is just timing and resources. Through my network of friends, I know a girl, a close friend of mine that works at the airlines, and I'm on the companion list. And I cannot name the airline, and any of that. But I'll leave it at that.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that exists, though, among airlines, is a companion list.
Yes.
So if you, all of us probably have friends who work in that industry.
Correct.
You just kind of got to nurture that relationship, basically.
Yes, yeah. If you're a close friend with one, you're allowed one friend on the companion list. One friend only.
Gotcha.
And there has to be a lot of trust involved because, you know, she's trusting that you're not going to say anything rude to any attendants when you don't make a flight and you're stuck somewhere halfway around the world. And, you know, or you don't get completely hammered on your flight and be rude to a flight attendant. Because basically what you do and say can be detrimental to her job. So,
of course.
We have this trust thing, and it's been 3 years now, and everything's going good.
Yeah, that's awesome. I hope you take her out to dinner at least once a year or something. Do something nice for her.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I got to buy her a car. Are you kidding me?
Totally.
I think it's like the ultimate sponsor. I mean, the value of it is in the 100,000 plus range of strike missions that I've done.
That's insane.
Yeah, and even get to fly business class.
Oh my gosh.
Like 40% of the time, you know, if the seats are
open.
It's
like wherever there's an opening, basically.
Yeah. I've got to fly 10-hour, 12-hour flights, 15-hour flights, business, flatbed. It's amazing.
That's crazy.
It's like unbelievable.
Do you have footage from the Desert Point sessions?
I have a lot of footage from last year, but not from this year.
Okay.
Because when I go on these trips, I don't go with the photographer because he doesn't have the pass I do.
Sure.
I can't afford to pay for him. So you just kind of bank on people being there and you approach him. And I usually carry a flash drive with me. And I just go on a whim and go, hey, do you have any footage of me? So, you know, I can't expect my best waves to be captured every time. So I'm just lucky I got as much still photos as I did.
Right. All right, cool. Well, we'll post some of those photos if you want to provide them.
Okay.
We'll post them on surfsplendorpodcast.com and I'll find footage of you so people can check you out. You know?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So we'll get into the show. Obviously, I sent you a couple of topics to discuss.
Yes.
The first of which was an email that I received from listener Thomas Pope. And I'm just going to read some of the highlights of the email. Basically, Thomas said, I've been surfing for about 2 years and recently had my first negative exchange with a more experienced surfer in the water. After this, and watching a few YouTube videos of brutal beatings of surfers on the beach, it made me think of why violence in this sport is so contradicting. After watching the Nathan Fletcher bodyboard incident at Pipeline, it's clear to see that he possibly didn't see Nathan Fletcher until it was too late. Does this really deserve a relentless fury of fists in the water? I try to be as respectful as I can, and it comes to the point where you almost need to be aggressive to catch a wave, and there will be more than likely some surfers on the other end that are not happy about it. We all have a love of the sport, and we took time out of our day to catch a few, so let's be respectful and friendly and have a good surf together. Thanks for reading, TJ. End quote. I replied to that email from Thomas and kind of just said, like, I watched that Nathan Fletcher video too, and I'll post that video on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. But basically, Nathan takes off behind the peak at Pipe, you know, in the right position to take off at Pipe to get shacked on the peak. And there's a bodyboarder taking off on the shoulder who never looks back at the peak. And so Thomas's point is correct. The bodyboarder probably didn't see Nathan, but also the bodyboarder didn't look. You know, like, you can't take off on the shoulder Pipe and not look back.
Correct.
And if you do, I mean, that's, people die at that wave.
Yes.
And so, is it worth getting beat up, or does he deserve to get beat up? I don't know. Is it justified? It could be argued that it's justified. The situation TJ was in probably wasn't life-threatening, and so probably unjust if he got, you know, beat up or yelled at or whatever. But my question to you is just, is violence ever warranted in surfing, you know? Can you imagine a scenario where violence is warranted? Because it's something we as surfers deal with pretty regularly, you know?
No, this is a difficult topic because I, you know, I'm not like a physically violent person. I have gotten to verbal altercations. And when you're surfing a wave like that, or anyway, even a trussle, this you guys, beginners paddle out. They paddle out with a lot of confidence and beyond their ability. And they don't understand kind of the etiquette in surfing.
Right.
And do I think that somebody should get beat to a pulp over it? I don't know. I can't answer it. But you know, the thing is, I heard Tamayo Perry got like his head scalped years back from a guy bailing his board. And I look at that, I'm like, I'd want to beat the hell out of the guy who bailed his board in front of me like that.
Right.
I mean, that's like a scar for life. And not only that, but that's crazy. Like the pain and the suffering and the medical bills. And,
Amayan Goodwin broke his leg when Cody Graham dropped in on him.
Yeah.
Back a year or two before that, I think.
So, I don't promote physical violence at all, but I couldn't imagine if someone did that to me and put my life at stake over their selfishness or ignorance. I can't answer what I would do, but I definitely think to people that don't normally surf these kind of waves and just show up for the first time or even the fifth or tenth time, they need to know the etiquette of surfing and the dangers involved. I think they need to educate themselves. They go out there with this confidence and ego and end up actually not only hurting themselves but others in the process. I had a guy at Lowers on Sunday when the swell increased, and this is a soft wave. He dropped in, like could barely stand up, and just shot his board out into five people. And I yelled at him. I go, are you kidding me? He came up smiling, ruining his board.
Were
I go,
you one of the five
no,
people?
No, I saw from like maybe a 20-foot distance. I go, are you kidding me? I told him, I go, why are you even smiling? Do you realize you could have speared any of these four people? These people like literally had a bale of boards. And he just goes, sorry, bro, with a big smile. I go, why are you even smiling? He didn't even understand.
Yeah.
He was more smiling at himself, like, oh, I fell. But he doesn't understand. He can spear other people.
Right.
And these kind of people will say, well, I didn't do anything. Nothing happened. And do they have to wait till a guy has a hole in his head?
Right.
Until he realizes what he's doing? He's not equipped for that wave, or he needs to get more practice before he even comes to learn how to surf a populated wave?
I think what you're saying is absolutely right. And I've realized it, but never really thought about it consciously, which is, it might just be today's kind of narcissistic culture that we're living in, but beginning surfers don't go through the steps of learning etiquette like they did when I was coming
up. That's correct.
When I was coming up surfing in Huntington, I didn't even go surf the pier until I understood what was really going on, because I just knew there was a hierarchy that I don't quite fit into yet. And so I had the respect to learn the ropes, and learning the etiquette of surfing is a multi-year process. You know, it's like, so I think what you're saying is right, is like kids learn to surf. They're like, I'll paddle out into the peak at Lowers and catch a set wave, or I'll paddle out at the pier in Huntington and catch a set wave.
They feel entitlement.
They do. And then what the problem is that's fine and dandy, but if you create a situation, or if you get in somebody's way and somebody yells at you, you need to put your tail between your legs and get at the back of the line. What kids do nowadays is start talking back.
They
or
do.
Like, or that guy, like smiling about it and like writing it off. And it's like, no. You were wrong. This is where you need to get in the back of the line. But they don't do that anymore.
No, they all say that. I love this comment. They all say, we're all just out here having fun. And I say to them, I go, you're having fun on other people's expense.
Exactly.
Is what you're doing.
Yeah. And I don't mean, this isn't directed towards Thomas's email, I guess. Like, I don't want to make him feel like he's the guy.
I'm just thinking of all the scenarios where there's somebody that feels entitlement, paddles straight up to the top of the peak, doesn't put their time in at the spot, and just says, hey, man, it's a free country, it's a free ocean.
Yeah.
And just his ability's not there, and they take off on the peak, drop in on people, or don't look, and they could really injure people, and I don't know.
I'd like to see a little bit more of that respect and etiquette cultivated in today's youth, you know? And so, I don't know, maybe we live in Southern California, and so our experience might be different than a listener who's in New Zealand surfing kind of wide open beaches. They might have nothing but politeness, you know? I was going to tell you a story. Southside Huntington last year, kind of around this time of year, US Open, you start seeing all sorts of people and behavior in the water that you never see throughout the rest of the year.
Yes.
It was pretty crowded, and it was right next to the pilings, like big south swell, kind of paddle out next to the pilings, and the waves are pushing. So it's kind of a treacherous situation, you know? And there was a lot of people in the water, and a set was coming, and there was a kid in front of me as this wave was approaching. So we both went to duck dive. He was 4 feet in front of me, I'd say. We both duck dive this wave. I come up and he's gone. And I look behind me and he's behind me. He's now 5 feet behind me. Right. So he duck dove in front of me, got swept over my back.
Oh my God.
And ended up behind me. So I kind of knew he was right there and I could tell that he wasn't really like the best surfer. So my intention was I'm going to duck dive under this guy instead of duck dive under this wave. Mm-hmm. I knew I was going to have to duck extra deep basically.
Oh my gosh.
And sure enough, he got sucked over behind me and ended up 3 feet or 4 feet behind me. So when I came up from the duck dive, I was like, what the heck? And I looked back and he was behind me. And I was like, I said to him, I'm like, dude, are you kidding? I'm like, you better learn how to duck dive before you paddle out at the pier. And he goes, what? F you. Don't tell me what to do.
Oh my God.
And I think he even tried to call me into the beach. Like, he's like, what, you want to handle this on the beach? And I just like laughed about it. I'm like, what? No, I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm just
saying.
I've
seen these guys do this. They you try to give them any kind of constructive criticism.
Yes.
And they lash out at you. Their ego gets a dent in it.
I'm ripping or like you're an amateur.
Yeah,
I'm just saying, learn how to duck dive. And this isn't based on my guess. This is based on what just happened. Like insane,
right.
You know?
Right.
So here's my other question about violence in surfing is is violence warranted would be if it worked. Like if I punched that kid in the face and then he never did that again to somebody else, or he acquiesced when somebody kind of gave him a critique, then I would argue like maybe there's validation to this. And where we see it work oftentimes is in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like guys who step out of line in Hawaii. I remember a story about Chris Ward paddling out a back door and just start burning people when he was like 18 years old, just taking off on everybody. Eventually, one of the guys goes, go into the beach. He went into the beach, got punched in the face, and they go, stop burning people. Don't ever do that again. He goes, all right, sorry. Paddled back out to the peak and sat in line and waited for the next wave.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but it's like, okay, violence worked in that scenario.
Yeah,
so,
I mean...
Is it different in Hawaii, and is it justified in Hawaii, you know?
In Hawaii, I don't... I can't answer that question. I don't condone physical violence, but, you know, I even have some friends that they get punched in the face for doing something wrong and they don't learn. They're
back
at it a year later doing it again.
They may become even more aggressive after that.
Right. It's like they need a lobotomy or something.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
they need some kind of brain work done. But I don't know if that works. I mean, it might instill fear into some people and make them not want to even paddle out at the spot.
Yeah.
But
which is the goal a lot of the time with localism.
Yeah. You know? No, I get that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what anyone would be thinking dropping in on everybody anyway, backdoor.
Yeah.
At that point in time, the person needs to figure out more about themselves.
Wardo, dude. I mean,
yeah, I
don't
know.
I don't know what to say about that.
I have nothing to say.
Exactly.
But, I don't know. And then the thing about localism that I was thinking is some of the people that do the punching at their local break carry that vibe out of their state, out of their country, to another break.
Right.
And I'm like, wait a second. We're not in your backyard anymore. Why are you treating my backyard like it's your backyard? It's happened to me a few times and I had to say something. I go, this isn't your backyard anymore and you're surfing it like it is.
Right.
And so... You know, as much as taking justice in your own hands sounds great, the problem is some of these people doing this kind of justice carry that mentality into other breaks. They might carry it to the mentalities. They might carry it to lowers. They might carry it to any other break on the East Coast. And you're like, wait, this isn't even your break. So at the end of the day, they see that it works. And they're like, well, I'm just going to carry this vibe with me everywhere and feel in my entitlement to every spot. So I don't know.
I think Thomas Pope, his email is right, though. It's like, it's so contradictory to the reason why we're all surfing in the first place. You know, like, if you're living with that vibe of just aggression, you're not really enjoying the act of surfing anyways.
Mm-hmm.
In order to enjoy surfing and perform at your best, you need to just be able to, you know, release that tension.
Yeah.
So, moving on to a much more enjoyable subject.
Okay.
Coco Ho Nude.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen that all over, like, social media.
How amazing is this, dude?
Well, you know, it's they did it, what, a couple years ago or last year with Slater. They had, like, nude athletes. So they're just doing another thing with nude athletes. And
it's ESPN's body issue.
That's it.
They feature nude athletes.
Yeah, so, I mean, the whole idea behind that is to show, like, the physique of an athlete, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she's in shape, and it was a good thing, and it was done in a tasteful way.
Yeah,
and I don't think it was done to, you know, make women look degrading or anything.
Yeah, no, I'm all for it, dude.
Yeah, I read the comments, and some people are jealous, and some people are saying that she's exploiting herself, but no, it was done in a tasteful way. I didn't see anything.
I don't understand that argument at all. Like, I fully sympathize with the women's lib movement aspects of it, you know, and I get it, and I'm all for, like, equal pay for equal work or whatever, but this isn't an exploitation at all. It's a celebration of beauty, you know, and it's like, Steph Gilmore did it before, and, it's just Coco's beautiful, and she's charming, and she's like, we love everything about her, and who doesn't love the female form? You know?
Yeah.
And she rips.
Yeah, like, I mean, they got statues of people nude in huge museums, and this is just what it is, only live.
Totally. You know? We don't need to kind of belabor this topic, because there's not really too much to say about it, other than she's surfing nude.
Yeah.
Have you ever surfed nude before?
I think I did.
Okay, what's the story?
As the Mentawai Islands, I think it was like 6 or 7 days into one of the boat trips, and I was getting jaded, I was losing my mind, so we went and surfed this beach break, which is rare, and there was nobody around, so I just, I think I was, I don't know, I had a couple of beers or something.
With other dudes or by
yourself? No, they were, I don't know what they were doing, they were like walking down the beach somewhere, I decided to surf nude solo.
Is it liberating? Is there anything special about it, or is it whatever?
I don't know, it's just, it's kind of weird because you feel the water all over your body when you're paddling.
Yeah.
You know, you don't feel any, like, material from a wetsuit or trunks. But I don't think it's very comfortable.
Right.
personally, I don't think it's all that comfortable with wax and all that. And
totally, dude.
You know, so I don't think it's like, oh, man, I was surfing so much better. No.
Yeah.
It's just something to do just to say you did it.
The other day I was surfing. The water's pretty warm in Southern California, and I was considering trunking it. And I was like, oh, I'll just put on my spring suit. And I ended I surfed in the spring suit, but I had a wipeout where my board just flipped over and I landed right on my butt on my fins.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And kind of got up and shook it off and surfed. And then I got home and I was getting in the shower. My wife's like, what happened to your butt cheek? I have a full-on slice on my butt cheek with a giant bruise surrounding it. And that's with my wetsuit on.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy crap, I was considering surfing in trunks. If I didn't have that thin layer of rubber, dude, this would be a gash.
Right? No, I agree with you. Yeah, of course, the safety issues.
Yeah, totally.
It's completely like, it's higher when you're surfing nude. But yeah, wetsuits protect you. Booties protect you.
Yeah.
I don't recommend that as an alternative to, I don't know, surfing better or anything. It's just something you just say you did. It's a bucket list thing.
Novelty.
Yeah, exactly.
So Mason Ho has been known for surfing nude, and I've seen videos of him surfing nude that he's posted on his website, and then I went back, like I told somebody about it, went back to find it later, and they must have deleted it or something. But he does tell a story about a time that he surfed nude in a contest. The videos that I had seen previously were just him surfing like west side Oahu. But we're going to watch his video right now. Okay. Mason Ho telling his own story.
This is the story right here of how I surfed in Australia in this contest butt naked. Just watching the contest in the morning, and they're like, oh, all these guys are in it. They're having an expression session. There's no, like, people from Hawaii in it. And I'm, like, trying to get into this thing. I'm, like, asking the director guy, like, hey, we need to get in. And he's like, oh, no, it's too late. I can't do anything. I was like, whatever. Getting in my car. And then I hear him announcing, like, oh, Mason and Granger, whatever, come grab your jerseys, hurry up and go out for your thing. And I was already in the car, and Coco's like, go, Mason, go, go. And I was like, nah, I'm like, I'm over it, screw them. Like, I didn't even have my surfboard. I had like a pair of my shorts and like our walking shorts. And then Coco's like, please just go out for me. I just want to see you surf out there. So I was like, okay, I was like, I'll go out for you. I'm like, you got a surfboard? I grab their surfboard and they jump in the water. As soon as I jump in the water, my shorts like fill up with water. Like, my sister's board's like tiny, so I'm like going underwater, like paddling. Oh fuck, I'm gonna screw these shorts. So I rip my shorts off and I put them on top of my head. So I was butt naked, and then I just start paddling out all, yeah, I can make it like this, because the pockets weren't filling up when it was around my neck. Yeah, I ended up surfing like the whole heat just naked. But the funniest part was I'd be like, there'd be someone going for the wave, kept just showing people, like cutting, like going right in front of people, and they're like, oh! And they're all looking at me, and they're like, how does this kid get away with this every time? That is why they call me Naked Mace.
Naked Mace.
That's pretty classic.
Now we got Naked Coco too, the Ho family, dude. All that's about nude surfing.
No, that's pretty nuts. So,
yeah, literally. I didn't think they were pretty, but
no. I'm just saying that to do that in the heat, that's.
I know, and he's doing hairs too.
Yeah. You don't get fined for that stuff?
I don't know. It's a good question.
They like to make any kind of money they can for in the ASP. Find this, find that. So
that's true. ASP talk. Did you watch any of the J Bay event last night?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't.
Jordy got a 10 in his heat. Yeah, like, he got a 9.8 and a 10, I think. So he got 19.8 total. Wow. Jordy's ripping, dude. Like,
I watched the highlight reel of him the night just before I went to bed, surfing J Bay, free surfing.
That O'Neill video that they just put out. I watched that too. How insane does he surf, dude?
No, amazing. So I obviously, you have the usual suspects that will do well in J Bay, I think. And,
which are?
Parco, Slater, Fanning, Jordy. I think those are the guys that have that smooth carving flow.
Yeah.
Because Jeffrey's Bay, I think, shows your strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
And it really shows a surfer's style as well, how they link in and out of the turns. So if the winds are offshore, those kind of guys will do really well. And
I should say day one is what we're at right now. Last night, day one ran, so while we're recording this. And they ran round one, and then I think four heats of round two.
Okay.
So Slater won his heat. Michelle Perez won his heat. Parco actually got second, but then won his second round heat.
There you go.
So he's through. Mick won his heat. Jordy won his heat. Everybody you just said did exactly what
and
he
I didn't
said.
Even watch the contest. Yeah, exactly. I just know by their styles of surfing. Bell's Beach and Jeffrey's Bay is a type of wave that that really shows what your strength and your weakness and your flow and because those waves have a huge open canvas and they're typically offshore. Now, I have noticed when the winds shift, people are doing airs at Bell's now.
Right.
So, which is unheard of 10 years ago.
Right.
And big scores are being given. So, with that said, if the winds are different at J Bay, this gives the opportunity to the other surfers whose strengths may be technical surfing.
Yeah.
And that will, you know, that'll help them out. But a guy like Kelly and Jordy, who are good at both, they're going to be definitely the top two guys, I think. Good at airs and good at power surfing.
I'm going to reserve, I don't know, judgment or expectation on the air game at even during the windy sessions. For one reason alone, and that is when we've seen it done at Bell's in recent years, it's one maneuver wave, basically. It's done, and then it's like Kelly's, you know, it's done into the flats, and that's it.
Right.
John's, it was kind of the same thing. At J Bay, I think if you try to do that one air, the wave's going to run down the line. Like, there's not really an end section to do it on, and you'll end up missing a lot of opportunity down the line. And I don't know that judges will look at that as a good thing. Like, you can do a massive error on one section, but are you going to give up another 100 yards of wave?
It has to be like a functional error,
right,
where you're like, it's kind of like doing a floater, only you're doing the air instead to clear the section. And it has to be on a really windy, bad winds.
But we've never really seen that done in competition. We've seen big airs, and we've seen those big airs at Bell's on the one maneuver, but I don't think we've ever seen massive functional airs. Maybe John's alley-oop at Bali was one that I could think of.
I seen Slater do an alley-oop at J Bay in 03, but it wasn't that big of a one. It was at the end, and it was really mushy and windy, I remember.
Gabriel did a couple rotators last night, but again, they weren't massive. You know, it's kind of like he did them, but it wasn't like a huge.
So with that said, then I guess a lot of the rail-to-rail flow power surfing, the people that link their turns in and out, you know, the closest you can surf to Tom Curran.
Exactly.
That's going to do it.
Yeah.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Have you surfed J-Bay?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Not.
Yeah, I'm curious.
It's on the bucket list.
And you're goofy footer, so do you have any thoughts on the goofy footers?
Yeah, I was thinking that about that last night. I don't think a goofy footer's ever won J-Bay.
Aki.
Aki, yes, but not when it's
not
been
since then.
Yeah, not it's been since, I think it was a country feeling contest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if he's won, I know he's won Bells a bunch. I don't know if he's won J-Bay. Did he win J-Bay when he won his world title in 99?
He won J-Bay. I don't remember the year.
Okay.
And
so it was in the 90s.
I assume it was a CT event.
Okay.
But I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I can't remember. But yeah, so with that said, it's been 15 years since
Goofy
Footers won J-Bay, which would be nice to see because I like the way Matt Wilkinson, Owen Wright, and the Hobgoods, the way they throw their fins out the back and blow the tail. That would be cool to see, like, you know, they put the hand on the deck, throw the fins out the back, see that kind of surfing at technical, like, surfing at J-Bay and then get backside barrels. I would really love to see a goofy footer win it, but...
If you had one goofy footer to pick to win, who would you pick?
Well, after watching Timmy Reyes and Matt Wilkinson, I like the way Matt Wilkinson does his backside off the tops.
Okay.
And I know Owen Wright does them just as well. But he's just got back on tour after being gone, so,
I'll pick Owen, you pick...
Yeah, exactly. It's just the same thing. Owen...
I love Owen.
Yeah, they're both... to me, it's like picking the same guy.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. Freddie P, I think he lost his heat, but... Or got second or whatever, but he was ripping. He surfed incredibly well.
Oh, yeah, no, he's definitely another really good, powerful, goofy foot that could do well at J-Bay. He knows how to go rail-to-rail, top-to-bottom... Like, fluid, smooth, power surfer.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay, give me your one pick to win the event. It doesn't have to be Goofy Footer. And give me your dark horse contender.
Oh, well. Well, obviously, Slater to win.
Sorry. Over Jordy, you think?
Yeah. Okay. Slater's won it more. He knows. I think he's put more hours in J-Bay maybe than Jordy as far as wave count.
I think surfing it
for that many years.
Yeah.
20-plus years.
Yeah.
Dark horse. I don't know. The dark horse guys are the guys that are the air guys,
okay?
In my opinion, because you wouldn't be betting on them. So I don't really have a dark horse. I mean, is Julian Wilson a dark horse? I don't think he's a dark horse.
Not really.
No, he's not. Yeah. So I don't really have...
Felipe Toledo?
No.
I don't know. You don't like Felipe?
No, I love the way he surfs.
Oh, okay.
I saw him do the hugest air rotation. I'm just saying, would I put my money on him winning J-Bay? No.
As a dark horse, I mean...
No.
No. Okay. Straight up.
I don't know. I don't know who I would pick. I don't know. I'd have to see the list. I don't have a list in front of me.
I'm going Jordy for win. Jordy for the win. I love Slater. I would prefer Slater, but I just feel like Jordy looks unstoppable.
Okay.
And then my dark horse, I'm going to say Adam Melling.
Okay.
Adam...
I need to see the list. Yeah,
okay.
I can't. I don't have the list of all the...
Adam Melling made the final with Jordy at J-Bay. I think it was 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And his style suits the wave. He surfs a lot like Mick Fanning, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I just think that he's a guy who just kind of never really makes it past round three. But if he is ever going to, J-Bay's his spot, you know. And so I'd like to see that, actually.
Okay, is Mitch Colburn on the CT?
No.
Okay, I would pick him.
Yeah, right. I would too. That'd be a good pick.
You know, because he's a power surfer.
He should be on next year, actually, yes. Based on his
record. I know that he was coming in a few of them. I don't know if it was like an alternate deal.
Right.
Okay.
So that kind of leads us into Bolido. You were talking about Timmy Reyes and yes. Wilco.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you're friends. We're friends with mm-hmm. Timmy. You've been on, have you been on trips with Timmy?
No, never.
Okay. But you've surfed with Timmy a lot around
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I remember when he was a mini Grom.
Yeah. So he just jumped from, I think it was 126th spot on the qualifying series to the fifth spot on the qualifying series because he won the event in Bolido, which puts him in contention to qualify for the 2015 WCT.
And we're already halfway through.
What are your thoughts on Timmy qualifying?
Amazing.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really like a dream because... you know, in professional surfing, when you're in your 30s and you're not on the CT, it's hard to make money.
Oh, yeah. And he's lost vans. He's lost a couple sponsors.
Yeah, you lose sponsors. It's hard to keep interesting, keep fresh. And he's been doing a good job at it, surfing all these exotic cold water spots. But essentially, if he gets back on the CT, he'll get a pay raise. Everything will be huge. And or not the CT, the World Tour, excuse me. So I think that's huge. And it's inspirational to others
mm-hmm.
Because most people probably wouldn't try
right.
That much later. And to win that event when most of the guys in the top 36 were doing it is huge.
Totally.
Huge. To get, I think that's his biggest win, and he did it in his 30s.
Crazy.
So
do you think that Timmy Reyes' surfing is on par with the guys on the CT right now?
Well, you know what? I will say this. He has the power surfing. He has the flow, and he has the charging. And a lot of guys may be good technical surfings in junk Huntington, but when it comes to those big waves, like Timmy gets high scores, 9s and 10s at Backdoor.
Right.
You know, and he
made the semis at Pipe with Slater that way.
Yeah, and you put him at Tabarua, you put him all these waves, he'll get big scores, which is important, you know, because those are world-class waves. You want to surf good in world-class waves.
Totally.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Luke Egan said this. He's like, I'm glad I'm known as the guy who surfs really good in good waves.
Yeah.
I would rather be known as the guy who surfs good in good waves than the guy who surfs good in shit waves.
Totally.
I mean, actually, it would be nice to surf good in both. But
of course.
If you were to pick one from the other, it would suck to surf like crap at G-Land and then surf epic at 1 foot Virginia Beach.
Well, I've struggled with that because I've surfed Huntington my whole life. I'll go on these surf trips and the waves are 6 to 8 feet and pumping. And I'm visualizing myself surfing well out there, but it's such a learning curve and
totally
it's
different.
So much faster and everything
yeah.
that I will flounder, you know, and I've struggled with that. I flounder a few sessions and then I just beat myself up and my confidence gets shot and I'm like, dude, I want to go out and get shacked and I can't do it. I think I should be able to do it, but I can't. And then you have to kind of rebuild and I've been able to, you know, get over that sometimes, but... Yeah, you're absolutely right. If you pull up to 8 foot cloud break, you want to get out there and get shacked.
It's totally different. I'm sure the women got a taste of that on the tour.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they went to 8 foot cloud break and they're like, wow, you know, and you got to see the weaknesses and the strengths in some female surfers from the others. And these are world class waves and it would suck to not be able to surf good in world class waves.
Right.
So back to Timmy, I think that. I remember seeing him do a lot of aerials and when he was on the QS before he qualified, I think in 2004, 2005, seeing some big airs from Timmy. So I know he can do the airs. If he could bring that into his heats, he'll be fine. I mean,
yeah.
He has the capability of doing all the airs.
Right.
If he does more of that in his heats, then he can beat these guys like Felipe Toledo on a one maneuver wave.
Right.
So the only thing I would say is just bring his air game into his heats. And I know it's difficult because how many guys do you know of tore all three ligaments in their knee,
right?
Like Timmy did. And I think he did that at Steamer Lane in 2005 or something. And that pretty much sidelined most of his World Tour career.
Right.
And he was number like top 7 or top 10 in the world at the time.
Yeah.
So to get over, and it's hard thing to get over when you tear all three ligaments and
right.
you're out of the water 9 months, to come back, oh yeah, I'm going to do an air on the flats.
Right.
You know?
Mentally to even like...
Want to do
yeah.
that because that could end... Not only your career, but surfing, high performance surfing.
Totally.
You know? So, anyways, yeah, just I know he has the capability of doing all those airs and just bring that into the heats. And
okay, so my scores. My pros and cons with Timmy. I agree with everything that you said.
Mm-hmm.
I also love the Timmy story. You know, him qualifying late in his career, or re-qualifying. I also like the approach that he's taken as a pro surfer, which is he is a free surfer and he's nomadic. He's always on the road, but he's picking cold water destinations. Like, mm-hmm. he's doing trips to Canada and Oregon and like all this stuff that most people don't go yeah. to. So he's like when Timmy Turner was doing the Indonesia thing and going feral for 6 months, but it was warm water, reef break that everybody would imagine wanting to go. Timmy Reyes, on the other mm-hmm. hand, is choosing the cold path that really nobody wants to go to. And so I love that angle, and I think it's marketable for a sponsor, which is O'Neill, because they sell
wetsuits. Yeah, the more rubber he's wearing while ripping, the more marketable.
So that's been his career path, and I think that's smart, but I think it's also where his passion is. I don't think it was, mapped out that way. That's what he does. But downside of Timmy, he's not the most exciting surfer to watch for me. It's a personal assessment mm-hmm. of Timmy's surfing. And it's not really a criticism. It's just how I view it. It's mm-hmm. like when he takes off on a wave, you know, I'm able to anticipate what he's going to do. And therefore, when he finishes the ride, it's like, yeah, he surfed that wave really well, but it didn't really raise my adrenaline level. Mm-hmm. John, on the other hand, I never know what the guy's going to do. And when he kicks out, I may be hugely disappointed, but I also may be a spike in adrenaline. And so that's my one caveat with Timmy, where it's like, I don't know how he can add that to his surfing, but I would worry that that'll translate to a lot of sixes on the judges' scorecards.
Okay, so you're predictable surfing versus unpredictable. There's very few unpredictable surfers. Those are, you know what I mean, like the Julian Wilsons and John Florence, Slater. There's a lot of guys on tour where you kind of have an idea, or Jordy Smith, whatever. There's guys on tour that you know how they're kind of going to surf it, you know. It's a very unique quality to have, to be unpredictable.
Those guys that you're talking about, though, they fill out the 12th ranking to mm-hmm. the 32nd ranking. So does Timmy want to join and then just fill out that bottom 20?
I think that everybody has the ability to do whatever they want. It's the mindset to change. So, right. I would say if he's gonna make the tour, he just has to think about becoming more unpredictable.
Right.
As you said, and it means taking more risks.
Yeah.
You got guys like Dane that are so damn unpredictable. You know,
he'll get best example.
Yeah, he'll get a 10 in one heat and then a 2 in another. It's a difficult characteristic to have to take those kind of risks and be able to advance, you know?
Yeah. I remember somebody talking about Andy Irons, that it was like offbeat jazz. It's like you see him approaching the lip and you think he's going to bang, but then he booms, you know, or he zigs when you think he's going to zag. And
it's like a guy bottom turning. You think he's going to hit a vert, then he does a carving 360.
Exactly.
And you're like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. And then you think he's going to do air reverse, but then he does something totally weird, like you don't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, that's kind of the surfing that I love best. But again, I mean, Timmy, I can't criticize the guy. I love him, and I love his story. Mm-hmm. But it's like, that's the one thing that I think is the difference between being in that top 10 or 12 on tour versus the bottom.
Okay. Well, either way, hey, predictable, unpredictable, if I'm making a world tour, I'm a happy guy. Even if it's for 1 year or 3 years, dude, and I think that when he gets there, if he gets there, he'll definitely, he knows he's been there before, so he knows what to do differently now. Mm-hmm. And also with finance and everything, you know, he's older, he'd probably save his money, and you got to be smarter. And because there's a lot of money to be made now when you get on the world tour, the money's a lot bigger too than when he was there 10 years ago.
Yeah,
so it's a second chance.
Another thing we can talk about, because we both have personal exposure mm-hmm. to it, is Sippo. Mm. Sippo, on the brink of getting knocked off tour the last couple of years. Last year, he literally qualified in the very last position only because Yaden Nickel lost to Mick Fanning in that quarterfinal heat at Pipe.
That was ridiculous.
Yeah. So if Yaden would have made that heat, he would have taken Sippo's spot on tour.
Yeah.
And so
it's true.
Sippo's in the same position this year with a string of last places on the CT, and then he's doing the qualifying events like the Bolito comp, but he lost in round one at Bolito, or in the first round, I should say. And now he's at J Bay. He lost his round one heat at
no
J
way.
Bay. And then surfed his second round heat against Parco and lost that heat.
Oh, my gosh.
So he's out on day one in J Bay. So what are your thoughts on Sippo? How do you account for what he's going through? Because, I mean,
okay,
I think the guy rips. We see him surfing at home all the time, and obviously he's on par with the best surfers in the world.
Yes.
Why is he having such a slump?
Wow. Well, you just brought up the fact that there was a heat between Yade and Nickel and Mick Fanning.
Right.
Where everyone, not everyone, but I myself thought Yade and Nickel should have made it because he rode the foam ball so deep.
Mm-hmm.
Is this karma? I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Brett Simpson's one of the best surfers in the world, and he belongs on the CT. I'd say he's one of the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And, is that like some weird act of karma? Because Poirier Nickel should be on the CT, if you ask me.
Right.
Because he rode that foam ball, like, through the barrel, and that was ridiculous. So, maybe it's not Brett's fault.
No.
I don't know, but I will say this, and I was thinking about this. There is one surfer that has lost first heat throughout the entire year, and I know who that is. It's Andy Irons. Nobody knows this, but in like 1996-97, Andy Irons, I think, lost first heat almost every contest and fell off the tour, only to come back on a couple years later and become one of the most dominant forces in surfing.
I don't remember that. Was that his rookie year?
Yeah, it was his rookie year.
Wow.
Yeah, he lost first heat and a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, and he had a fight to get back on tour through the QS again.
Brutal.
Next thing you know, he's one of the most memorable surfers in surfing history, and he's Kelly's biggest rival.
Right.
He was one of the gnarliest surfers ever.
Right.
So that could be Brett Simpson's inspiration. The year's not over, but what I'm trying to say is if he's bummed about losing this much, just think Andy Irons did that before he became who he is. And if Andy would have given up, he would have never been Kelly's biggest rival, three-time world champion. I mean, the stuff he did after losing and falling off tour was huge.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, these kind of things just are a test to see how strong you are, and you know.
You got to text that story to Brett, dude. Well, so when he wakes up in South Africa,
why don't you put this podcast?
Yeah, exactly.
No, but it's true because Andy Irons, I remember, was his first rookie year, 97, I believe, or something, and he lost a lot and fell off the tour.
What do you think accounts for Brett's losses the last year or two? How do you assess that?
I can't say. I don't know. Because I remember doing contests and then losing, going, what the hell am I doing wrong? You don't get the right way. If this happens, that, you're just like, you don't know what the hell's going on. And people are saying he's drawn really difficult seeds because he's such a good surfer. And by losing, you become the low seed going against the high seed. So he's surfing against guys that he's on the level with. That could be one thing. But, I mean, how many times can you get the lower end of the stick?
That doesn't account for all of it. I think a year ago, he was surfing really poorly, and he looked just like his confidence was shattered, and he was falling apart, and it was all his fault, basically. I would blame his mental state.
Yeah.
Specifically in Bali, against Oni Anwar, you know, the wild card.
Yeah.
Oni did an air and got one good score, and then Brett got like three or four opportunities. Oni never backed up his score, but Brett got three or four opportunities to rip waves, and he fell, and he slipped, and he just never capitalized. And it's like, there was zero reason why Brett should have lost that heat, but his mental game was so off that he did. And so there was a lot of instances like that where you can only point the finger at Brett. But I feel like in the last 6 months or so, especially in the qualifying events, he's been surfing pretty well. Like in Cabo, for example, at the 6-star, he surfed really, really well. And then he'll come up against a tough draw and he'll lose with like a 17-point total. So then you go, okay, that wasn't your fault. That can happen to anybody. That happens to Slater and Parco, no big deal. But when you now compile that on top of 2 years of poor performances that were his fault, it's kind of like you're just adding, you've done well and you've gotten back on the ladder, but somebody kicked the ladder out from under you now. Yeah. So how do you give somebody the motivation to climb back up after they've kind of overcome some big obstacles and they're doing everything right, but now luck is working against him?
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
What the luck thing. I don't know if that's a karma thing. I don't know what that is. I don't know. Luck is a strange thing because you have people that gamble, right? And they get on a winning streak. And you could talk to a gambler, and when they get on a losing streak, and they keep losing and losing, they have to step away. You can't keep pushing through because you'll keep losing and losing. Right. You almost have to step away. And what am I supposed to say? Step away from the tour.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Go free surfing, go on the search.
And that's the problem for him is even when the
tour... You don't have time to do that kind of stuff.
Even when it ends, he can't just stay at home for 3 months.
No.
You got sponsor obligations. Yep. The qualifying series starts. It's like...
Yeah, it's nonstop. So it's hard to just step away and take a breather and come back. It's not like you have like millions of dollars in the bank where you could do that and then come back.
Right. Tough situation.
It's a very tough situation. Hopefully he can use his the birth of his daughter as a motivating factor to have to make it happen.
Yeah.
But that's also stress too. So I don't know.
Probably hard to enjoy your newborn kid when you realize you got all this pressure coming in from the back.
Oh my gosh. I couldn't imagine being a professional surfer with children.
Right.
That's got to be the most stressful thing.
Yeah. Crazy. The upside to that is making more money now than 10 years ago when guys had kids and could barely afford to travel around the world.
Brett won 2 U.S. Opens. Yeah. And probably won one of the best U.S. Opens in history.
Yeah.
2009.
Against Mick Fanning in the final.
Yeah. He beat Slater. He beat Mick Fanning doing an air, and I don't think Mick was doing airs back then.
Yeah. Crazy. So, Sippo, keep your head up, dude. Mm. This isn't the worst thing ever. We all believe
in Andy you. Irons has lost numerous heats.
Yeah, I like that story, dude. Yeah. Do you want to talk? We'll file this one under the subject heading of gossip.
Okay.
The gossip column.
Yeah.
Alan Sarlow. Kind of a famed Malibu surfer. Yeah. I don't know if the international community knows him so much, but he's a professional surfer from back in the day from Malibu. Still lives in Malibu. I think he works as like a realtor.
Yes.
Yeah. So Sarlow, big Malibu surfer, sued for STD transmission.
How did you hear about this? Because I was shocked when I read this.
Dude, I got my ear to the ground with surf news.
Are you going on like courtreporter.com and Googling surf? That's pretty nuts. Because
this is a full gossip column story, mm-hmm. but I still feel a need to share it because it has implication for the pro surf community. Quick details of the story.
Mm.
Mary Bigler filed a lawsuit Tuesday in Los Angeles Superior Court against Alan Sarlow. Her allegations include battery, negligence, emotional distress, and misrepresentation. She seeks at least $5 million. According to the lawsuit, Sarlow was married with 2 children when he and Bigler began a relationship. Before the relationship became sexual in nature, Bigler asked Sarlow if he had any sexually transmitted diseases. After engaging in sexual intercourse with Sarlow, Bigler tested positive for an STD, including herpes. It was, quote, "It was later learned by Miss Bigler that during the course of her relationship with Mr. Sarlow, that he was engaged in sexual relations with other women, including a young girl he met at a surf shop, to whom he also transmitted herpes." End quote. After Bigler told Sarlow he gave her herpes, he agreed and or acknowledged that he had done this, the suit states. Sarlow told the plaintiff last summer that the girl he allegedly infected with the STD sent an email to his wife telling her that she had contracted herpes from him. So, Sarlo's getting sued for transmitting herpes to a love affair. It seems super gossipy, and it is, but my question is, like, fidelity is the real topic here. Like, traveling pro surfers,
mm-hmm.
Groupies are throwing themselves at them every stop they go. And I would say not even pro surfers, just you traveling the world. You go to Bali and there's prostitution.
Yeah.
There's those things everywhere. And they see an American and you have money. So for a pro surfer, this is even more an issue. How practical is fidelity for traveling pro surfers is my question to you, Rezzy, Mr. World Traveler.
It's a sad story for the Sarlow family. I know Alan. I've booked Mentawai boat trips and he was one of my customers.
Really?
He went with his son. And I know I surf Malibu a lot. I see him at Lowers a lot. I ran into him when I was a Grom in Hawaii. This is a sad thing for the family. And there's two sides to every story, first of all.
Yeah.
So I'd like to, hear the other side.
Yeah, it's all allegations.
Regardless, number two, I didn't know he had more than $5 million to be sued. So must be doing well, or I don't know what she's thinking.
Yeah.
It's a tough situation, and I personally, as far as this subject is concerned, I hope, the family recovers through this.
Yeah.
And I know it's got to be really difficult. Really, because I remember when my parents got a divorce over an issue, it was tough, and I was in my 20s, and it was difficult. And yeah. So I hope they get through this. How important is fidelity through pro surfing? Or,
yeah, how practical is it even? I mean,
look,
you could be a pretty straight and narrow dude, but there's a lot of temptation.
There's a lot of temptation, but you got to know before you get into being a pro surfer, or you got to know what you're in for, you know? And if you're a strong-headed person, you could pull it off. Look, if you're married and there's a problem with your marriage, you got to discuss it. And I think most people, they don't discuss it. They hide it. And they, you know, a pro athlete, I don't care what sport they're in, you know, they may travel and they might have a problem or a fight with their wife or something. And then they think by, you know, having sex with another woman, that will just, you know, make the problem go away or make them feel better about themselves. I think it's very important to, the whole point of a relationship is to communicate.
Yeah.
So if they communicate with each other, if they have any tough times, they'll get through it. But, I mean, with that kind of temptation, that's...
Here's my question.
What?
How practical is it even? I mean, does a scenario exist where you can live that lifestyle and not cheat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, look, I quit drinking, let's just say that, right? And not because I thought I was an alcoholic or anything, but just for my health.
Yeah.
People are drinking all around me. I'm not like freaking out or you know what I mean? Or if you quit a drug, let's mm-hmm. just say you have a drug problem. I mean, you got to be able to handle being around
right.
drugs, not taking it. And I'm, it's a weird comparison to make to,
no,
to women,
not.
But yeah. an addiction is an addiction.
Yeah.
So if you... are going to be surrounded by women and you're going to be on tour, you got to be strong that if you really do, you know, love your wife,
right,
that you wouldn't cheat on her. And
you got to actively commit
yeah.
to knowing these temptations are on the road,
right,
and I'm committed to
yeah.
focusing on my surfing, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's you can't be 100% selfish, and
yeah.
I could see, you know, that being an athlete, the ego, the fame, the money, there's, you know, you become selfish.
Yeah.
I think they, many times a world champion will say it was the most selfish year of their life.
Right.
They will say that. And they will have wives and say, I'd be out of the zone with my wife at dinner. I'd be out of the zone. You know, I remember Mick Fanning saying something like that. He's
yeah,
like,
I remember that too.
Yeah. And so you have to be really selfish, and that's dangerous.
Yeah.
When you're in a relationship.
Totally.
How could you be in a relationship when you're selfish?
Right.
Right?
Well, I remember somebody talking about Taj. About that's the reason why Taj has never won a world title, not because he was selfish, but because he liked partying and
mm-hmm.
chicks, and he likes
mm-hmm.
all this stuff that comes with that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So he's indulging in the lifestyle of being a pro surfer, but what, you know, the downside of that is a perpetual fifth place on the tour,
mm.
you know, which is still really good.
It's great. Yeah, if he's doing that, if he's doing that and partying, imagine what he could do if he got on the straight and narrow.
The
you know?
Difference between that and a world champ is foregoing the alcohol and the women
yeah.
and just surfing.
Focus.
So modern surfers are bringing their wife and kids on tour.
Yeah.
Parco, CJ, Kelly Slater bringing Kalani, his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in Fiji, I think this past year, he had his daughter with
yes.
him. So
Josh Kerr brings his family.
Yeah, that's right. And so do you think having your family unit with you on the road, is that helpful towards your professional surfing? Because it does kind of prevent you from indulging in the lifestyle that comes with it.
Yeah.
Or is it a hindrance because now you have this extra distraction?
Okay, that's a good question. First of all, it's very expensive.
Well,
all right? Very expensive.
The only guys doing it
yeah,
are the top five.
The names
yeah.
that you named, they're probably making seven figures or close to it annually. So, yeah, I mean, it could work both ways. I mean, imagine if you're having a, before your heat, you're trying to get your kids and your wife out the door and you get in an argument.
Oh, God.
Kids are, you know, it's added stress. But it can also, it all depends on the type of person you are.
Yeah.
Or it could calm you down and keep
mm-hmm.
you focused at night, going to bed early. It all depends on, you know, the individual.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't have a family, so I can't really.
Right.
But I'm just looking at it like if I had kids and they're all screaming in the morning, or if I had an argument with my wife at night or something.
Yeah.
It, while you have a heat going on. But at the same time, if you know, if your past was that you're a party animal when you were younger on the QS, and now you're more mature and you're on the world tour, the family unit can help keep you grounded, focused, yeah. and make you and not make you feel as alone.
Right. I think that the best surfing that I ever do is when I am living in the moment and really at peace with myself, and just when I'm actualized.
Yeah.
When I've forgotten the stresses of the day and I'm just living for this isolated experience, kind of letting the energy flow through me, you know, and just not even thinking about the lip that I'm going to hit, just like letting it happen. And so I think for those surfers, if you're able to bring your personal life where you feel that way, you're at home, comfortable with your family, that's your true self. You're able to bring that bubble with you on the road and kind of live that way throughout each stop on tour and recreate that experience where you're most comfortable. That might be the most successful scenario for you. If you're constantly trying to shift gears of like, I need to like forget about my family and focus on this heat and focus on winning.
Yeah.
You're going to hit the right mark occasionally, but you're also going to miss the mark occasionally. I think Slater's the one guy who's found a way to kind of, wherever he is on in the world, he's at home. You know, he has these pockets of people that he knows everywhere around the world. His diet is consistent everywhere he goes.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the same people, Stephen Bell up until recently, Kalani Miller, like that he travels with everywhere he goes. And so he's able to just kind of like be at home on every single wave. I think that's the key to success, you know?
Yeah, no, he's doing it right, but I'm sure he's made some huge sacrifices.
Absolutely.
Huge. I mean, just with his daughter alone is a huge Absolutely. Sacrifice. So, you know, he knows you have to make big sacrifices if you want to be a multiple world champion.
Yeah.
You know, and he made big ones, you know.
Yeah.
So.
For sure. Couple of topics that I don't think we're going to get into just because of time constraints, but I do want to point to them. Mm-hmm. We had a lifeguard die in Newport Beach this past weekend.
Yes. I've been thinking about this.
Yeah. Well, let me give the backstory real quick so listeners who don't live locally understand. Ben Carlson died on Sunday, July 6th. The waves have been pretty big in Southern California. So after he rescued a swimmer who was struggling in 6 to 8 foot surf at 16th Street in Newport Beach, at 5 p.m., Carlson, the lifeguard, jumped off a rescue boat. So he wasn't even swimming from the shore. The rescue boat mm-hmm. came in from the ocean. He jumped off the rescue boat and saved the swimmer and then disappeared in the surf. One helicopter, 7 boats from various agencies, and at least 25 people helped in the search for Carlson. He eventually washed up ashore near the pier, which is about less than a mile away.
Yeah.
3 hours later at 8:15 p.m. and was pronounced dead shortly thereafter at Hogue Hospital. It's unclear exactly what went wrong and why Ben drowned, but he was an active surfer and swimmer. He spent time surfing the wedge, which is a big wave spot, so he's very capable, athletic, and he was also the first lifeguard to die in the line of duty in the 100-year history of the Newport Beach lifeguard. What are your thoughts, Rezzy?
Okay, this is, I'm putting all this together. Now, I saw another article put out by the Orange County Register, which said that he died at 28th Street. But it had like this aerial photograph of this heavy rip current at 16th Street. Rusty Long commented on it. He said that Ben Carlson, is that his name? He said that he's able to handle giant surf in Puerto Escondido. He's seen him surf giant surf. I mean, much heavier rip currents, much bigger waves. That, to frankly, this last swell was not that big of a swell. It's an average swell that comes of good size
happens multiple times a summer.
It's very difficult to die as a surfer or a swimmer in Southern California when you're that experienced.
Right.
If you have a surfboard, it needs to hit you in the head.
Right.
Knock you unconscious. He didn't have that. And being that he's a professional swimmer, he's getting paid to swim. And quite frankly, I've seen these lifeguard tryouts. They're very difficult. And a lifeguard commented, too, on the Orange County Register article. It's very difficult to qualify. You're very well trained at swimming. A lot of professional surfers that careers and they try to become lifeguards. Some don't even make it because they have strong upper bodies and lower bodies that can't kick well and pass the swimming race. With that said, Ben Carlson was a great swimmer, a good enough surfer to surf Porto.
Yeah.
So with all that said, it's a mystery to me. I don't see how he can just drown. Okay, and the waves were at 16th Street were only like 8 foot faces.
Right.
And I think he's smart enough to know not to dive head first or go head first over the falls, you know?
Yeah.
It's a mystery to me. I would have to see the autopsy, blood toxicology report. I don't know if maybe he was on medication, maybe he had cough syrup. I don't know.
Yeah.
But there's got to be something. That I'm going to take a guess that hindered his cognitive skill. Like, for instance, if you go underwater and you inhale 1 foot or 6 inches before you hit the surface, you are inhaling water and a wave comes. Something has got to alter his judgment because the waves weren't that big at 16th Street. I know where that is.
Yeah.
And then the Orange County Register said he's at 28th Street, which actually has no waves.
Right.
During that swell angle, it's a wintertime spot. So whether it's 16th or 28th isn't the factor. It's the fact that this was a professional swimmer, a very good surfer, a lifeguard, and Puerto Escondido is 100 times more scary and gnarly than Newport Beach. So with that said, it's a mystery, and I just have to see the autopsy far as blood.
It is a mystery. It's a tragedy, first and foremost. Yeah. I mean, it shocked the community and kind of a lot of people
totally.
Knew him. And
it's a shock.
It's so sad, but I feel the same way as you in that I can't... It would be too scary, I guess, for me to just think that this could happen to any of us or the most qualified among us, even.
Right.
I need to know that something else was at play here that I'm not at danger in the water... And I could just be swept away at any moment. You know what I mean? Like, I need to rationalize it to myself somehow. Because that's too scary to believe.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I think that they should look into this case. And if there's any kind of evidence they can find through an autopsy, they need to release it to the public. Because it would help other lifeguards.
Right.
And it go, oh, okay, so that's the reason why.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he took aspirin. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Whatever.
Whatever it is. NyQuil. I have no idea. What I'm trying to say is it would help other lifeguards in training because this guy, I seen all the social media posts and apparently everyone that surfs in Newport knew him.
Right.
This guy was a good surfer, a good swimmer. So you want to know because it scares you. Like, it wow, is, could, yeah. could I die surfing 16th Street? Like,
right.
Or swimming,
right.
You know? Because I always knew that if you surf and if a board hits you in the head in the barrel, you can knock you unconscious regardless of if it's a 6 foot face wave or a double overhead wave.
Right.
But without a surfboard, it's baffling. So I want to know what else was at play here.
Yeah.
And there's no shark, you know, attack thing.
I wondered that too, like if he did have some sort of head trauma, like when he was rescuing the swimmer, if that swimmer's knee maybe hit him in the temple.
Yeah.
Or something.
Anything.
Like
any you know, any kind of health condition that he may not have known about prior.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's
curious. It seems though that the lifeguards did everything right. I mean, the fact that the boat was there, they were on the scene instantly trying to figure out where he was, you know.
That's a mystery.
It really is. It's a tragedy though. I mean, such a sad situation. The kid was 32.
Especially for the parents, too.
I know.
You know, it's very difficult.
The other thing that... you talked about Tom Curran surfing Jay Bay, and word was... The most famous footage of Tom Curran surfing Jay Bay was that shot by Sonny Miller during searching for Tom Curran. And Sonny Miller news just hit yesterday that he passed away from a heart attack at the age of 52 or 53.
So young.
He passed away on July 8th. So lots of sad things happening this week. I mean, but especially timely for Sonny, just in terms of that, I mean, the current footage at Jay Bay, the Jay Bay event's happening right now. That is the most iconic footage from that location. So that's another tragedy that just struck that we can't go without mentioning for the show.
Yeah, no, Sonny Miller is, I mean... I grew up to the Rip Curl search videos, and if it wasn't for him, there would be no search videos.
No.
And he did it in film, which is amazing.
Yeah.
it's a sad loss, but he has a legacy he's left behind, which is amazing. Those totally. Videos are timeless.
They really are. Did you come up with a Duke and Kook for this week?
Oh gosh. Okay. Duke and Kook.
Who's your Duke? Come on out.
Okay. The probably Timmy Reyes.
Oh, nice.
For winning that contest, because that's a huge accomplishment.
That's a great
to call. Do that far in your career later on is huge, because most of the people are like constantly competing nonstop, yeah. And Timmy just like does it part time competing.
Right.
So that's huge. It's major with all the good surfers that were there as well. Jordy Smith was there. Yeah. So and then the Kook. Well, I saw your Kook, which is a good one, so I don't want to steal that one.
Okay.
But my Kook would have to be at Malibu. This lady, this older woman.
When was this?
This was on Sunday. Okay. No, Monday.
Okay.
I paddle out, and usually my first wave dictates how I'm going to have my session, so I paddle straight into a set. I'm so pumped. And I know Malibu, everyone snakes you, but eventually they kick out, or if they snake you, they know how to get out of the way, whatever. This lady on like an 11-foot longboard, she's been snaking everybody and sitting the widest. She drops it on me, and I see her on her stomach, and she's on her stomach for 3 seconds. Then she's on one knee for like two more seconds, and then finally she gets up, and I'm right next to her. I'm like, excuse me, lady, can you get off this wave? She goes, I was up first, in this like old maid, like, I was up first.
While I'm standing,
I'm trying to talk to her. She goes, I was up first, and my I threw me for such a loop. I'm like, I just saw you crawl up like a child, you know, and so... I'm like, okay, maybe I could bump her rail off. And her board's so big, the thing's like a train. I couldn't get off the track. She grabs my suit and throws me down.
No.
I was like, I can't believe it. So she, you know, I wait for her to paddle back out because I was just so, I was like, oh my God, this is a bomb wave. Went all the way like close to the pier and remained head high the whole wave. I go, are you kidding me, lady? You know, did you not see me get up first on your inside? She goes, I was up first. I go, you were crawling up. I saw you on one knee. She goes, that's how I get up. I go, that's not considered being up first. Secondly, I'm on the inside. And she was arguing with me. I go, lady, you are so delusional that you will pass a lie detector test.
Yeah.
You know, that's how delusional she was. And, you know, after about 30 minutes, she finally came up and apologized to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she actually did apologize. But it's too late because I was out of the zone. I wasn't getting sets anymore. She just kind of put me in that bad vibe. But, yeah, that was the Kook.
That's crazy,
for the week,
dude.
For me. So.
Did I see you post something about that online and other people commented like...
No.
Oh, I got burned by that lady too.
No, somebody else. No. But when I was in the water... Everybody else said they got burned by her, and I was talking. They're like, this lady is unbelievable. To say that she's up first, and she literally—it's actually the first time I've seen somebody stay on one knee and on their stomach for so long while riding the wave.
Wow!
It couldn't have been any more farther from the truth that she was up first. Let's say she was up first. Let's just say, I was already on the inside.
She was off on the shoulder.
Yeah, she's way off on the shoulder. Yeah. So whatever.
Insane, dude. Back to that etiquette conversation we were having. Okay, so my Kook for the week is the fisherman who hooked a white shark on the Manhattan Beach Pier, fought it for 45 minutes on the line, and then cut the line as a group of swimmers approached. The shark ultimately bit one of the swimmers, and the swimmer thankfully lived, but it's been on the news and everything.
Yeah, I saw it. It's terrible.
There's video of it, and... There's been a couple of white shark sightings in Manhattan Beach in the last couple months.
Last summer,
there was a big one, yeah.
People would not even want to surf there.
Right. But nobody got bit, I don't think, right?
I don't think until now. Yeah.
And so they're saying, basically, there's footage that exists, so we can verify all these facts. But they're saying the reason why this attack happened was just that it was a provoked attack. The shark was agitated by being on the line for 45 minutes. Mm. And then... In the video that's filmed from the pier over the shoulders of the fishermen are kind of laughing about it.
Terrible. Yeah. I was so upset about that.
Were you?
What kind of world do we live in when people like to see other people fail? We like to see other people get hurt.
Yeah.
And that's what people want to see, apparently. And these people laughing and giggling while someone's being attacked by a shark?
Yeah.
It's sickening. And these could be like fathers. They could be husbands. I mean, these are... If I ever saw my dad laughing at somebody getting attacked by a shark, I would never call him again.
Yeah.
I would never talk to him again. Yeah. Like, I don't even want to be associated with a person that laughs at somebody else while they're suffering. Right. Or videotapes it and just sits there. Doesn't even use their phone to call 911.
Right.
Uses their phone instead for an Instagram post of a guy getting attacked by a shark.
See, that's what the social commentary was like too online. And to be honest, when I first watched it, I didn't feel that much vitriol. Like, I felt like the guys on the pier weren't certain that it was actually a shark attack that happened. They knew there was a shark and they knew there were swimmers, but it's like they weren't sure that the shark had bit the guy. Mm-hmm. And there's a process of that you kind of hear them go through of coming to the realization of like, oh, did he get bit? Wait, is he screaming? Oh, do you think he got bit? What's happening? What's happening, you know?
Yeah, no, I get that. But I mean, at one point, what level of education these people have to not even take a... I mean, come on.
Right.
There's a shark in the water.
Right, exactly.
There's people swimming a few feet away from it.
Right.
What do you think? Is a dolphin that bit the guy? Or, right. I mean, like, at some... I mean, nobody was like... The way that they were talking...
I agree.
...was like, it was no big deal. It was a joke. I'm right. Like, this isn't a video game
right.
where you get to do over again. This is actually happening. And anybody, and I'm sure everyone's seen the movie Jaws.
Right.
I mean, how does that not come to mind, like, that this is actually a serious situation and it's life-threatening?
Right.
And they, to me, the people videoing and the commentary in the background show that they didn't give a damn about human life.
Right.
To them, it was entertainment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, your sentiment is definitely echoed across the internet. And Alex yeah. Gray even chimed in and Instagrammed the video and then like a long explanation of how irresponsible the actions were on the fisherman's behalf. And the fisherman's name, Alex called the fisherman out by name. The name was released.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So like, there's not going to be any legal action taken. Like, he didn't do anything illegal, but I have a feeling that
his name is going to be just defamed. Like,
dude,
I don't want to be associated with that guy. If yeah. that guy was my friend, I wouldn't be his friend after that video.
Right.
I'd be like, you don't... Seeing that, you'd be like, this kind of guy wouldn't have your back.
Not to mention, you can track people down now on the internet, find out where they live mm-hmm. and all the death threats that could be yep. involved.
Yeah, it's like, terrible.
Stuff happens. So, crazy situation.
It's inhumane, the way yeah. I saw that video.
Crazy situation. My Duke, I'm giving to Sonny Miller, who we just discussed. For his vivid depiction of Tom Curran, among many other things. Sonny passed away from a heart attack on Tuesday, July 8th. Rest in peace, Sonny. One thing I'd like to say about Sonny Miller, reviewing some of that video footage, was just, again, in today's narcissistic society and culture, everything that is done with a unique thumbprint. Like, Kai Neville puts a clip out. We know it's a Kai Neville clip. You don't even have to see Kai Neville's name. You just know it's his
yeah.
because it's stylized like right. Kai Neville. And that's not a knock on Kai. I like Kai. But everybody who does something just wants their own name plastered on it and wants their own thumbprint on it. Sonny Miller footage, you go back and look at it and you don't think, this is Sonny Miller footage. You think, this is Tom Curran surfing beautifully at Jay Bay. So what Sonny did was get out of the way of great surfing. He documented it. He's in the background. He's the transparent lens that we're all able to view the beauty in its natural state. And I really admire that about Sonny. And that was the stuff I was raised on. And it's like today's thing, you'll see, I watched a great all the Nambia Skeleton Bay footage yes. of Benji Brand and some other guys. There was a 6-minute edit that was put out a couple weeks ago.
I watched it, yeah.
But it's so over-edited. It's like, I just want to see the surfing, but it's like cut to, flashback to this, rewind this, fast forward this, discolor that, hyper contrast this, blend in this clip to that. And it's just over-edited. And it's like, you get done with the edit and you're like, I have a headache from watching that. And I got to see a couple good waves, but I'm so distracted by the thumbprint of the editor. Mm-hmm. Sonny Miller, perfect example of just getting out of the way of beautiful surfing. That's my homage to Sonny.
Well, I got to agree with you. Your Duke and Kook is 10 times better.
No, not...
But I'm not going to steal yours, so I had to think of a different...
No, dude, not at all better or worse. They're equal.
You know, but so...
Sonny's
I agree
man.
With you 100%.
Sonny's yeah. the man, dude. That's a style of filmmaking that we really don't often see today.
No, I agree. I mean, I was it inspired me throughout my surfing life watching his films. Like I said, with the search videos.
Yeah,
all of them.
And you were on Team Rip Curl, right?
Yes, just right after he searching for Tom Curran.
Yeah.
So that pretty much I came in when I think he was just had stepped out. I don't know.
Cool. Do you have a must see moment this week?
Must see moment. Well, I really like speaking of the GoPro thing. I think that Anthony Walsh barrel. Four or five barrels in one wave at Desert Point was pretty nuts, because it's not only difficult to get a wave that gives you four or five barrels in one wave, to capture it from that angle without any water spots, without any, like, he was changing hands with the GoPro, like from right hand to left hand, then looking at himself.
Right.
I was like, dude, I feel like I'm in the barrel.
Yeah.
That was a pretty amazing footage that was released in the last, I don't know, 7-8 days.
Was he there when you were there?
No, he went the next 12 week later.
Okay.
I believe so. And then I think he was at a different wave in Indo.
Okay.
I probably shouldn't say the name.
While you were there.
Yeah, while I was there. And then Kobe Abertins was also very amazing.
Was his a GoPro or was it a shot?
No, Kobe Abertins was a shot from the beach.
Yeah, I saw
but,
that.
But, I mean, I saw the wave he got at the grower was just giant. And then I saw the one he got from up the point where he gets three barrels on one wave. That was surf line wave of the day.
You were in the water that day?
No, that was also, there was two swells. It was one June 19th and 20th, and then I think on another one that came in towards the end of June. Okay. There was two big swells, and surf line did the coverage of both those swells. Right. So the second swell was, I think, even bigger than the one that I got.
Got it.
So that's
tell me about surfing that wave a little bit. What's it, like, what are the...
Okay.
What are the... highlights or lowlights of it? It looks okay. Like it looks perfect, but it also looks incredibly difficult to surf.
Yes. It's not as easy to surf as you think. You can get going too fast.
Right.
And you can be going too slow.
Right.
Okay? This wave, first of all, it changes. It'll go from flat to double overhead in a matter of hours on tides.
Okay.
So there could be a swell in the water, a pumping swell, and on the wrong tide, it'll appear... If you rolled up to it and you didn't know anything about this wave and say it was 20 years ago and you rolled up to it for 2 hours watching it and it was chest high, you'd be depressed and leave.
Hmm.
Only to hear by a different group of people that rolled up 2-3 hours later that it was double overhead and firing and you wouldn't believe them.
Right.
This wave does that. I've surfed many waves in Indonesia, been all over the Manawais over a dozen times, and there's no other wave that breaks like Desert Point the way it'll not break for hours and then go to double overhead.
Right.
And it's really tidal. It's got some strange current that runs through it. And then the wave, like I said, when you drop in on it, it's got this huge wall in front of you. It makes you think that you need to race it when you need to slow down. And then other times when you slow down, you need to race it.
Mm.
It's about timing the lip with the curtain. And it's a lot different than most other lefts that I've surfed in Indo. It's different than Greenbush. It's different than Hideaways. It's different than No Can Dewey. It's a different barrel to ride. It's very technical. And it's challenging. And I can imagine being backside. Wow. Because it's hard to push through the back of a barrel backside.
Yeah.
And at the end of the wave, or towards the end of the wave, it gets thicker at this part called the grower, and you can't push through the back of the wave backside. So I see a lot of people get injured.
Can you straighten out?
You can... once you're locked in, you're locked in. You can't straighten out. And the safest place is the barrel. No.
Yeah.
You'll get axed on the head if you straighten out.
Right.
So with that said, I've seen injuries, you know. I've seen people get the best barrels of lives. I've seen guys that can hardly surf but have a lot of confidence, get the best barrels alive, bending at the waist instead of the knees, and they get the best barrels of the life, sometimes better than mine. I'm going, this son of a gun has no clue.
I hate that, dude.
I'm like, this guy has no clue. He's bending at the waist. He just got a better barrel than I did all day.
I hate
that. Because he doesn't know how to pump in the barrel, so he's sitting deeper in the barrel. You know, all he can do is just do the power stance, and by doing that power stance, he's getting the deepest barrel of his life, bending at his waist, and the barrel's so wide, it has enough room for him to bend at the waist.
And then just gets blown out.
Yeah, it's blown out. I'm going, oh my God, maybe ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
So, anyways, it's far away from the nearest medical place. You have like 2 hour drive.
Oh, okay.
So there's dangers to that too. I see a lot of people end up with scars on their face for life and have to leave the spot, you know?
Crazy.
Go get plastic surgery, literally. So.
Yeah, that's crazy. I forgot to mention oh no, I didn't. Never mind. Mm. I was going to say my must-see moment.
What is that?
Shane Dorian's wave at Puerto Escondido.
That's right. Okay.
I have a feeling everybody's probably seen it at this point, but you haven't, go to surfsplendorpodcast.com. I will have the clip. Basically, Shane, he was in Indonesia. Yeah. I don't know if it was for that swell.
It was for the second one.
The second one. Mm-hmm. And then flew all the way back to Hawaii just to get boards to then fly to Puerto Escondido, where he only surfed, I think, he said he got 3 waves or something, or surfed 3 days.
He didn't do the big wave contest?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right.
So goes to Puerto Escondido. It's this massive, massive swell in Puerto. He was out there with a couple of other dudes. And ultimately, he said he surfed 4 hours and caught one wave. Mm-hmm. They show him paddling into one other wave that he barely misses, which is just so scary looking. It's like awesome that he didn't go, because the guy would have died probably. But then waits for another one. Free fall drops the first half of the wave. It's a paddle in. So paddles into the peak at Puerto. Free fall drops down the first half of the wave. Sticks it. Barely kind of... doesn't even drive off the bottom, kind of mid-face bottom turns up under the curtain. The thing folds, gets blown out the end of it, and it's just, I mean, it's a wave, I don't know, 20-plus foot, but it's Puerto, and it's a beach break, and gets blown out onto this frothy kind of monster-y end section. And it is arguably going to be one of the waves of the year in the Billabong XXL Awards. There's another honorable mention of Gabriel Villaron that gets a sick one.
Yeah.
Not as clean, more frothy, and when he comes out, he makes it, but then kind of gets knocked off. So it's not as beautiful as Shane's, but honorable mention.
Yeah.
So those are my must-see moments.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, Shane Dorian is one of the most amazing surfers from 1 foot to 100 foot.
Yeah.
That's very difficult to be that versatile.
Yeah, and arguably in the best shape of his career.
Yeah, it's he's one of the... the few free surfers left getting paid, and he's doing it in his 40s, and it's amazing. He's right. Got the ultimate life. I mean, I see his Instagram. The guy's going snowboarding. He's going to Jaws, and then he's doing this.
Bow hunting.
Yeah, the guy's got an endless bank account. The guy's rolling.
Yeah, huge, he does,
and he's
yeah.
charging, and he's putting his life on the line.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
He's got the, a little bit like you, he's got the Benjamin Button status going on, like reverse aging.
Yes. that was funny. Yeah, no, I literally saw gray hair where the roots were black. I was going, what the hell's going on?
Really?
Yeah, I was plucking some, like I have like a couple gray hairs on my sides. I plucked a couple and I saw the roots were black. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm going backwards? I had to photograph it and post it because my friend didn't believe it.
I missed that. I didn't
see
that.
Yeah, no, I posted it. It's pretty nuts.
Amazing, dude.
Yeah, literally, the root was black. Like 50% of the hair was black from the roots and the other 50 was gray. I was like, okay, I'm going backwards. It's great. Gotta
bottle that and sell it, dude.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's the show, dude.
Okay. Well, thank
Surf
you for
Splendor.
Having me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rezzy.
Yeah, no worries. Epic. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for listening to Surf Splendor. That is the show for today. Thank you to Tom Resvin for sitting in and co-hosting. I'm curious to hear what the listeners think of Tom, and I encourage you to come to surfsplendorpodcast.com and leave a comment on today's show's page. I could talk to Tom endlessly, and so hopefully you guys can listen to Tom, because he did not begin to unpack his vault of surf experience and theory and just topics that he's interested in, that he's got some really, really interesting ideas and things that we can discuss at length and in depth that I think would actually be a great fit for the podcast. So give me your thoughts on Rezzy, and if you enjoyed him, and if you did, I will then, you know, tell him how many fans he has out there, and hopefully we can get him on future shows. And then, of course, as always, I need to encourage you just to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher. That helps other people to find the show. It helps the show grow. Just continue telling your friends. Why not follow us on social media? You can just repost the show. Share it on your friends' walls. If there's a particular episode that you like, put it on their wall and say, hey, check the show out, you know, and hopefully, I mean, if we had every listener
that we have do that to one friend, in theory, our listenership could double in the next month. And who knows, it could grow exponentially from there. So I encourage you to do that. The show's completely free, but that's your investment in the future of the show. The more people who are listening, the more shows we will be able to produce. So let's keep this snowball growing and gaining momentum. So I thank you for that. Also, make sure to check out the Spotify player on our website. We have playlists from every single episode. So if you're wondering about any of the music that is used in Surf Splendor, everything is available to listen through Spotify or links to the music where it exists on YouTube. So you can listen to everything for free on surfsplendorpodcast.com. And of course, I'll have all of the ancillary videos that accompany today's show that Tom and I discussed throughout the episode. So that's pretty much it for me for this week. I will actually be out of town for the next 2 weeks, but I am intending to record shows remotely and publish from out of town. So we should keep everything on track. I will look forward to hearing from you in between now and then, and you'll hear from me, you know, next week. So this is your host of Surf Splendor, David Scales, saying thank you for listening, and until next week, aloha.